Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Van Lathan is a host of many podcasts, including Higher Learning with Van Lathan and Rachel Lindsay, The Red Pill, and The Ringerverse. His energetic gift of the gab makes him a natural for the medium. He also used to work for the tabloid site TMZ, where he had a bit of a dust-up with Kanye West. Van talks about that incident and other raw truths in his memoir, Fat, Crazy, and Tired, Tales from the Trenches of Transformation. It's an intimate and inspiring book in which Van writes about his lifelong struggles with being overweight and dealing with anxiety and depression. Van joined us from his home in LA, and we talked about his book and his belief that being fat in America is sometimes harder than being black.
As a black man, there are places where I go in the world and people make space for me. If you're fat, then there's no place where people actually want to make space for you. They want you to be smaller so that you take up less space. And you're constantly told, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, that the space that you're taking up, you don't have any right to it, and you should be smaller. So in that respect, and I'm not in any way discounting or minimizing sometimes how hard it is to be a black American, but I'm saying in that way, it just feels like there's no quarter for you sometimes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about your mother's cooking of Southern food and what you describe as the taste blanket. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So in Louisiana, food is a big part of our culture. A lot of places in the South, particularly Louisiana, where food is amongst the things that we are most proud of, you know, like our state has an amazing culture, mm-hmm. amazing people, but you know, we're not going to be proud of any of those numbers. We're not going to talk about the GDP of the state. We're not going to talk about any of that. We're going to talk about how we can cook. So we soothe ourselves with that. So for me, after a time, I started to connect food with emotion. I started to use food as a mechanism to help me cope, to reward myself, and to calm myself down almost. And that's kind of what the taste blanket is. It's like you've had a bad day. You can't control how you feel. You can't control the trauma you feel. You can't control the reaction to the trauma you feel. You can't control anything. But what you can control is like when you go to McDonald's, they're going to be there. Like when you would go to like a Bennigan's, they're going to be there. And when you go there, you put the taste blanket on, which is whatever food you're eating. And for that like one moment, you feel like there's something there to make you feel better. And I think a lot of people, myself included, use food like that because food just won't say no. Food may, in order for you to be healthy, you have to say no, but food never will. And there are very few people in your life that are that way, that just will not say no to you, no matter what you're doing. So it can be a blanket that you drape over yourself all the time.
Yeah. You have this very powerful essay called There's a Shotgun Under My Bed, in which you talk about mental health in the black community. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was kind of about, that is about me contemplating suicide during the pandemic. And the funny thing about it, if there is a funny thing, was that the moment I had the ideation, I realized it. A lot of times in our community, what we don't have is the opportunity to prioritize our mental health. So for me, that happens, right? And right away, I call a therapist, my therapist. And I say, what does this mean? And she goes, okay, this is what this means. I need you to get up and I need you to take all of the ammunition that you have for the gun and I need you to give it to somebody to hold for you. I need it out of the house. So I think about how that connects me to the community where I come from. Number one, if I'm still back in Baton Rouge and I'm growing up in South Baton Rouge where I'm from, the first thing is I don't have a therapist. That's the first thing. Like nobody had a therapist that I knew when I was growing up. So there's no one for me to call and get the advice of how to protect myself and how to protect my brain. Number two, I don't think growing up that I had a friend that I could call and say, hey, I'm coming over to give you ammunition to my gun because I don't feel comfortable having it, that doesn't judge me because of some of the stigmas around that. If I'm back at home, it's like, are you crazy, bruh? You losing your mind? Tell me what's going on. And I don't have anybody that just goes, hey, you want to drop that over? You can drop it here. So I think in LA, what I've been able to do, and that comes with proximity to people who can help you. That comes to being in a different type of society. I think sometimes being mentally healthy is as aspirational for a lot of people where I'm from as it is being rich. And there was privilege involved in me being able to identify just how unhealthy I had become. And in my ability to fix it, there were things I had access to that a lot of my community doesn't. So that's a very long-winded answer. But the reality is that I learned that by going through some things. And I learned that by comparing the things I'm going through now to things I went through when I was a lot younger.
It's a very thoughtful answer. Thank you for sharing that. Very well said. Let's talk a bit about your career at TMZ. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be the black guy at TMZ?
Probably what it sounds like, yeah. it was challenging, but like I said, it wasn't something I wasn't used to. It was challenging and it was eye-opening because it divorced me away from some ideas that I had about things, you know? I used to think that intent was the only thing that mattered. And now I know that that's not true. The only thing that matters is what happened. So a lot of times you would do something, right? And even if you didn't intend to hurt a community or to affect a community, it doesn't matter that you didn't intend to. It only matters that you did. And the reason why I'll say that is because intention should be used proactively. Right? I should intend not to hurt you. So if there's something that I think might injure you, I should avoid it or put it delicately. If you don't enter with that intention, your intention doesn't matter. And I think what I would see at TMZ all the time was they put things up and they would be like, oh, well, we're not trying to offend anybody. Well, what did you think was going to happen? A lot of times our pain, our friction is used to make content because you can get a reaction out of black people. You can rile them up. That same thing is used for commerce. That same thing. We feed into that sometimes. And I was right there. And I was in the middle of an organization that did that. And what I was attempting to do was throw a little water on it, was to diffuse some of this, was to make sure that I was never compromised there. But it was incredibly stressful. It was a full-time job being a black guy at TMZ. And it was draining. That doesn't mean that my time there was bad. I adored my coworkers. And me and Harvey got on pretty good for the most part of it. But it was interesting being in a situation with people who you thought were decent people, who pretty much were decent people, that just didn't give a damn whether or not the feelings of your community were hurt. And you start to think, is everybody like that? Is that just the way things are? Because where we are, we're thinking about this stuff all the time, but everybody else is living their lives. And I'm like, it's interesting. So it wasn't the most comfortable place, but I learned a lot about culture and I learned a lot about media.
Well, that's something, yeah. You became kind of notorious for a segment on TMZ when you challenged and argued with Kanye West. Can you set that up for our listeners and share what you were feeling during that experience?
Yeah, Kanye West came into the office, and he was on one, and he said he was talking to Harvey and Charles, and he had brought Candace Owens with him, and some kind of way they got to talking about slavery, and he said, slavery, it's 400 years. It's 400 years, and it's all of y'all. That seems like a choice to me. Now, when he said that, I didn't respond at all because it wasn't my conversation. But then, moments later, he turned around and he goes, does it feel like I'm thinking freely? And I said, no. It doesn't feel like you're thinking anything.
And while you are making music and being an artist and living a life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice. Every day we have to walk into that truth while you choose to say things that, to be honest with you, dog, are nonsensical. And frankly, I'm disappointed I'm appalled, and brother, I am unbelievably hurt by the fact that you have morphed into something, to me, that's not real.
If you don't mind my asking, how did Kanye respond after you said to him that he had turned into something you didn't recognize?
Oh, he actually listened. He came over and gave me a hug. Mm. I mean, look, Kanye West is not a bad soul. Mm-hmm. He's just one that's incredibly impressionable. He's one of those guys that like is getting new information all the time. Think about it. He's done nothing but create since the minute that he had the freedom to do so. And there are a lot of other things.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to sun him or anything like that. There's a lot of other things that he probably hasn't considered. But that doesn't mean that he gets a pass for that. There's a debt that we owe to the people that survived that situation for us to be here. And we just can't let that type of talk become mainstream. So it was important that I said something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right to do so, definitely. Since we're in Wisconsin, we have to ask you, what does Brett Favre's 399-yard, four-touchdown performance against the Oakland Raiders in 2003 mean to you?
I always thought about that as a human being defeating grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why the game is so memorable.
And Lisa Guerrero, welcome to Oakland, where the overriding story took place yesterday afternoon in Mississippi when Brett Favre's father, Irv, drove off the road and died, apparently of a massive heart attack. And then, cruel as it is, Brett Favre had to make a decision. Does he play tonight or doesn't he play tonight? He has chosen to play.
I understand the bond between Southern boy and Southern man that was father and son. And what Art Irvin Favre meant to Brett Favre and how hard it was for Brett Favre to get over that and kind of, you know, battle those demons in front of everyone. So he comes out and he has this amazing game. It's one of the most memorable games in Monday Night history, not because the game meant anything, but because the opponent that he was facing that night wasn't the Oakland Raiders, who you and I might never face. I don't know if you played in the league, but you and I might.
No, I never had a chance. I got cut in training camp.
There you go. If you and I might never play against, but we both have been up against grief before, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, him going out and throwing for 399 yards, I think it was four touchdowns, against Oakland that night was him beating grief. And so when my father passed away, I thought that that's what I had to do. And I remember as I'm driving over the Mississippi River Bridge to go to the funeral home to talk about him and to pick out the hat that he's going to be buried in and the suit and all that stuff, I'm thinking about Brett Favre. I'm thinking about 399 yards, and I'm thinking if he can do it, then I can do it. I'm thinking that everybody needs me to step up. This was up to this point, the defining moment of my adulthood. How is Van going to respond in front of his family, in front of his uncles, in front of everyone to the death of his father? Is he going to step up and take care of everything, pay for everything, be the man that his dad would have wanted him to be, or is he going to shrink from this? I just kept thinking, man, Brett, when he was dealing that day. Not only was he good, he was perfect.
You don't know how you handle those things, but he's doing it because he's Brett Favre.
Third down and 11, and he slings it perfectly into the arms of Donald Driver and takes that to the 19-yard line.
And I kept thinking I had to be that. And then I got to the funeral home. I'm thinking about it, and I fumbled. There's this moment where everybody's sitting in there, and my Uncle Craig walks in, and my Uncle Craig and my dad look exactly the same. I mean, when I say exactly the same, they have the same face, but they stand the same. They wear their hat the same. These are country South Louisiana men. They smell the same. And I looked over, and I called a timeout. I got to go. So I walked outside of the funeral home, and I just stood in the Louisiana afternoon, just looking out over Maringouin. And I respect Brett Favre. I respect what he did. I respect his ability to conquer grief and go in there. But I wonder now if I ever had the chance to talk to him, if that was his way of grieving, if football was what he shared with his father. So it ended up becoming the thing that helped him cope the most. So, but for me, I just couldn't defeat grief. I had to deal with it, and I still haven't.
Mm-hmm. It's hard. Yeah, exactly. You write in your book that, quote, peace is the answer to every question I've ever asked in my life, unquote. So what things are on the horizon for you that will offer that peace?
Oh, nothing. Nothing, man. You can't quantify, like, you can't define what's going to bring you peace. It's like it's homeostasis, yeah. Right? Like, when I look at my life, I don't do anything to try to achieve peace. I try to be accepting of things that bring me peace. Because, like, we won an Academy Award. Now,
yeah,
for our short film that we made, right? We won an Academy Award. Okay, now, what's the next one? What if we don't ever get another one? What if we never make it back? Are you going to be okay? I bet you will be. So peace is just an understanding that you're mentally, physically, and emotionally where you're supposed to be. And man, you have to surrender a little bit to get there.
Van Lathan is the Academy Award-winning producer of Two Distant Strangers, now streaming. He's also the host of several Ringer podcasts and is the author of Fat, Crazy, and Tired. Find out more about Van at WPR.org/beta.
It was a coincidence that they had a synth. He didn't like synths, but it was the cheapest way of getting a kind of the sound that he wanted to get without hiring in lots of other musicians.
Coming up, Ben Wardle joins us to talk about his biography of Mark Hollis, the man behind the beloved British new wave band Talk Talk. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.